Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here. We have a number of bills that are here for public hearing and possible work session. We're going to start off with House Bill 2660, since Representative Olson's here, and I know he has other commitments. So we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2660A. Jeff?
Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, House Bill 2660A comes to us from Representative Olson and Senator Brzozinski. This is a bill that allows court discretion in ordering an ignition interlock device in driving under the influence of intoxicants diversion cases. If a defendant submitted to a chemical test of his breath or her blood, with a result of less than a 0.08% by weight result, and the chemical test detected the presence of alcohol only, it reorganizes the fee and license suspension portions of the ignition interlock device laws.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. And Jeff Rhodes, your counsel, has done an outstanding job as usual in kind of reporting what this bill is all about. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, Mr. Chair, but the idea behind it is to, look, you know the history of what's happened with driving under the influence of intoxicants in the early 80s. The legislature moved forward with the diversion program, which I thought was, having been a trooper at the time on the road, understood that concept, and it made sense to me, first-time offenders being able to have that opportunity to go diversion, especially when they may have made a major mistake in their life driving home intoxicated. This bill deals with the issue of ignition interlock device that we moved forward with over 4 years ago. And Senator Thatcher was a key sponsor of that, moving that forward. Clearly understand what that's all about. But there tends to be a little bit of a problem, as you and I have been involved with, especially the Measure 91 movement of that committee, joint committee, this session, as well as Senator Cruz. We have a little bit of an issue involved because a person can be arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants tonight, not have any alcohol in their blood at all, and let's say, for example, may have been smoking marijuana, and that caused the intoxication. In the process of how we've moved forward with the legislation over the last few years, this individual, not having any alcohol at all, would be tagged with an IID from the courts. This bill, all it does is basically give discretion to the courts to make that call, as Jeff had described, from a 0.0 to an 0.07 for blood alcohol. And I think actually page 2 of the bill identifies it quite well. And that's under, it actually starts on line 19. The person refused to submit to a chemical test of the person's breath or blood, or the person submitted to a chemical test of person's breath, blood, or urine as required, and the test disclosed a blood alcohol content of more than 0.00% by weight, but less than 0.08%, and disclosed the presence of a controlled substance. So that's what we call the combination or the combo. And the only other way then is on line 24, sub B, the court may require that a proof ignition interlock device be installed if it's between, and it's clearly, under an 07 or 07 and under. That's it. That's how simple it is.
All right. What's that? Did you want to go ahead and make some statements?
Yes, Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee. My name is Josette Hugo, and I'm here in behalf of my daughter, Adrienne Kramberg, and I'm submitting her testimony into the record. And most of you know me as a staffer here, but I'm here as a citizen today and as a mom. And so I'm going to just run through her testimony briefly and why I'm here. This bill was not introduced with Adrienne in mind, but it clearly could have been. And I think that her story will kind of put a face on this bill for you. So she's been under the care of, first of all, she suffers from chronic depression and severe anxiety disorder. And she's been under the care of a physician for a number of years, particularly the last 4 years at OHSU Clinic in Scappoose. On the evening of October 20th, she was having a particularly serious anxiety attack. And so she took the anxiety medication. And after about 3 hours, she wasn't experiencing any relief, so she virtually doubled the dose. She took another full dose. She did fall asleep on her couch. The next thing she's aware of is she's driving in her car to St. Helens because she had this feeling. St. Helens is 7 miles away from Scappoose, so it's not a great distance, but at any rate, she had this compelling feeling that she had to, that her daughter needed to be picked up, and her daughter and her husband at the local bar down in St. Helens. And I guess the mom chip clicked in because she felt she had to go down there and give her daughter a ride. So she does. She goes down to St. Helens, and of course, the daughter is not there. So she's went back outside and was kind of standing around her car and for a while. And I guess a neighbor noticed her and called the police, thinking that she was either inebriated or lost. While that was happening, while the police were being called, she did get in her car and was making her way to her dad's house, which is about 6 blocks away. The police did stop her. She was going about 10 miles an hour on the back streets of St. Helens. And they gave her sobriety or a field sobriety test, which she failed. So they took her to the station and gave her the breathalyzer. Well, she had no alcohol in her system. It was a 0.00. She asked if she was going to be taken to the hospital, and they said no, that they were going to book her. So they booked her into the county jail, unfortunately. And she was charged with a DUI. In January, she made her first appearance at the court. Her attorney recommended that she just ask for diversion because she'd never been in trouble before. So that's what she did. The next time she was in court, she explained to the judge what happened. She provided documentation from the doctor and from the pharmacy about the prescription and this kind of things, that she was legally taking this and had never had a problem before. And the judge said she was sorry, but unfortunately there wasn't anything she could do about it, that she had to impose certain stipulations. So she was ordered to pay the court $550, attend the victim's panel, submit to a drug and alcohol assessment, and have a breathalyzer installed in her car. And when Adrian questioned that, the judge said, I don't have any choice in this. It's not clearly not appropriate in your case, but it was out of her hands because that's what the statute says. So this is why Adrian is wanting to testify today, because if House Bill 2660 passes, at least it gives the judge some leeway in being able to consider circumstances. If someone, I mean, she's 45 years old. She's never had anything but a speeding ticket. And now she has to endure this breathalyzer in her car, which is stressful. And, in fact, she has begun walking to work. She has been walking to work rather than have to go through that process of using the breathalyzer. It's humiliating in front of her children and her grandchildren. And she's, you know, obviously she's terrified that someone in town is going to see her doing this. That's a minor thing. But at any rate, for her, it's very stressful. There are people who say that a breathalyzer needs to be installed in the car regardless of the reason you are driving impaired, because some people go back and forth between drugs and alcohol. I think that could possibly be the case, but the judge should be able to see that. We have someone with multiple arrests or whatever that has a record here, and so okay, I could see that. Sometimes people say, well, the judges are too busy, they don't have the time to deal with this kind of thing. If we're going to say that judges are too busy to evaluate the situation, I fear for our entire justice system. So I'm asking you, she is asking you today, to please pass 2660 so that, and I'll say in her own words, so that each situation can be assessed on its own merits by the court, the individual given the best possible treatment options, and the use of the auto breathalyzer be used only in alcohol involving involved driving offenses. So thank you very much for hearing her testimony today.
You bet. Thank you for coming forward and presenting it. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Thank you all very much. I have one other person. I'm going to go ahead and call up Gil Meyer on this one while Gil's coming up. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on 2660?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do support 2660, and we thank Representative Barker for bringing it forward. We've seen it in our own clients as well. I won't belabor the point. There was a woman who was a realtor, and she had oral surgery and then inflammation and infection from the oral surgery, so she was given medication for that, and it looped her out, and she did get a DUI. She was impaired from the medication. But because of the lack of discretion here, she was forced to have the ignition interlock device in her car. But as a realtor, she was often carrying around her clients in her vehicle. She shut down her real estate practice for an entire year because she was too embarrassed professionally to have to abide by the restrictions of the machine in the presence of her clientele, and she didn't want the reverberations of that to move forward into her future years as a realtor. So we do think it's important for the court to have discretion, and we think this is a great addition and a great change. Thank you.
Questions?
I guess I have one. Badger. And maybe we can just talk offline, but when it was discretionary, the courts rarely, if ever, made it so that the person had to install it. So I guess if we're going to go this direction, I would rather we went for an opt-out to give the judge a reason to opt them out rather than the other way. Just something to think about.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, I think signaling at least to the court that the court has the discretion to exercise their assessment and their determination for the person in front of them is the important critical piece. So,
I guess to a sense, I would almost think this is almost an opt out. I mean, I understand what you're saying. A true opt out is that you have to have it unless the court says differently, but this is basically has the parameters of it has to be 00 and less than 008, and then I guess with the controlled substance has to also be present, if I remember correctly, as to setting it up. I don't have it right in front of me.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, that is correct. It's a case where if there's any combination of alcohol and drugs, regardless of the BAC, there will be an ignition interlock device mandated. It's only in those cases where it's below a .08 and it's alcohol only that the judge would have the discretion. Now, the judge could still look at somebody's record and assessment and say, you know, this was a .06 case, but I think you are appropriate for an ignition interlock device because this was a terrible accident. I see in your record that you've had other problems with this and so on and so forth. So it's only in those very particular cases.
So it would be automatically put on if there was a combination of alcohol and drugs.
Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher, that is correct. Yes.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2660. Open up a work session on 2660.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2660 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2660A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I do have some more questions on it before I commit to a yes on it. So.
All right. So objections, Senator Thatcher. Is there anyone else? Please show on the votes for today that we take Senator Burdick excuse for illness. Where motion carries, Chair will carry 2668 to the floor. We'll close that work session. And let's see where we're going to go. Like all these other people, the reps are coming in. someone go to the top. Okay. You want to take Gwen?
Sure.
All right. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2609.
Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, House Bill 2609 comes to us from Representative Barker and Senator Brzozinski. This bill establishes that an information or complaint can be deemed verified if the complainant certifies sufficient grounds to believe the defendant committed an offense. It states that false certification is a Class A misdemeanor. We have no amendments. There's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, and the bill is ready to move today.
All right, so Gwen, why don't you come on up. While she's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2609? All right, go ahead.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Gwen Baldwin, here today representing the city of Beaverton in strong support of House Bill 2609. This bill allows electronic filing systems, such as Beaverton's municipal court, to remain electronic throughout the entire process by making a small procedural change in connection with the electronic filing of misdemeanor criminal complaints. House Bill 2609 gives prosecutors the option of verifying a misdemeanor complaint by certification or by oath, which would help reduce waste and improve operational efficiencies. Currently, Oregon prosecutors who use or plan to use an electronic document management or case filing system are required under Oregon law to include a verification of the complaint. And under Oregon law, the act of verification means a statement under oath that is verified by a notary public. That requires the once electronic system, accusatory instrument, must be downloaded, must be printed out, must then have a notary seal applied under oath or affirmation. Then the document must be scanned back into the system, uploaded, and then the printed paper is disposed of. This is the hallmark of an inefficient electronic system. But in all fairness to past authors of the state's criminal procedural code, this was not something anyone anticipated when it was drafted in 1972. House Bill 2609 provides the solution to this inefficiency by allowing prosecuting agencies to electronically certify a complaint in a misdemeanor criminal prosecution in addition to being able to verify the complaint. And if there is a false certification, it's a Class A misdemeanor. So there's a level of equity to this. House Bill 2609 does not mandate any change for any prosecuting office's policies, practices, or procedures. Misdemeanor accusatory instruments can still be verified if desired. The bill simply provides an alternative that, for those agencies that use an electronic document management or case management system and want to improve their operational efficiencies and reduce waste. House Bill 2609 is a common sense update to the Oregon Criminal Code, and I urge your support and a due pass recommendation. Happy to answer any questions.
And are there any questions? Gwen, thank you very much. We're closing the public hearing on House Bill 2609. Open up a work session on House Bill 2609.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2609 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2609 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. And
you're the sponsor.
Yeah, I was going to say the chair will carry this one as well. All right, so we're closing the work session on 2609. I see members have just walked in timely, and so we'll go ahead and move to those bills that I have for get their testimony. So what I'm going to do is first open up. All right, so Rep. Parrish did not have you down, did not see you at the first, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to start off with that bill since she's been here the longest. House Bill, and this is to take testimony from the representatives. House Bill 2776A.
Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, House Bill 2776A comes to us from Representatives Parrish and Taylor. This bill allows a peace officer to apply to a circuit court judge for an ex parte emergency protected protective order provided that the victim consents. It establishes that the court may enter the order if the court finds probable cause to believe that the officer has responded to a domestic disturbance that requires mandatory arrest and the person is in immediate danger of abuse by a family or household member. An emergency protective order is necessary to prevent the person from suffering further abuse. It states that an emergency protective order expires 7 days after entry and provides that violation of an emergency protective order constitutes contempt of court. There are no amendments. There's a minimal revenue and minimal fiscal and revenue impact, and the bill's ready to move.
All right. Good morning. Apologize, but didn't see you on the list.
No worries. Good morning. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland Tualatin, and here to bring you House Bill 2776. This bill has come from our community in Clackamas, where the good police chief in Lake Oswego brought this to our attention, that Oregon is a state that does not currently provide an emergency protective order to a victim of domestic violence in the field, and other states do this, so we're not plowing any new ground here. So House Bill 2776 would allow a police officer in the field to offer a temporary protective order in the case of a domestic violence situation. We went through and work grouped this bill a little bit during the session. There were some concerns that came up, which is how we got to a dash a engrossed bill that we're bringing for you today. This bill passed unanimously off of the House floor. Allows a 7-day protective order to be issued in the field. It does not interfere with custody or checkbooks or any of those other types of things. It is simply a place, a way to put some space in between a victim and an abuser. We're excited to bring you forward this bill. It would be a new tool in the toolbox. The bill, a temporary protective order does need to be served on a respondent in this bill. So it's same type of process that we currently use, except we're just allowing a short 7-day reprieve. And if you think about, you know, when these incidences occur, they don't tend to happen Monday through Friday when the court is open. They happen in the evening and they happen on the weekends, and they tend to, you know, have substance abuse that goes with them and all of the situations that make a domestic violence situation very caustic and inflammatory. And at that point in the middle of a weekend, if you have, you know, my speech on the other side, if someone gets the hell beat out of her on a Thursday night, probably not getting to the courthouse, especially if your courthouse isn't open on a Friday, to get to a point where you can get a temporary restraining order. A lot of times a victim will make the decision after a few days of cooling off that, frankly, she's going to go back to that abuser. This actually puts something in her hand that we hope is a catalyst for her to move forward and make a decision to take that piece of paper, go into the courthouse the next week on a Monday or a Tuesday, have 7 calendars days to make that decision and have this be the catalyst to move her out of a situation where it could be a chronic domestic violence situation, but empowers her as a tool, or him. We know this happens on the other way too, but it empowers a victim to move forward with their life. And so we would certainly urge your support and get this one passed and signed this year.
Thank you. Rep. Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Prasansky, members of the Judiciary Committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, House District 41, which covers Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about House Bill 2776, which establishes temporary emergency protective orders for victims of domestic violence. And I want to thank Julie Parrish here for working on this with me. Earlier in the session, all of us here, all the legislators, received an email report from the Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team and their recommendations. First on the list of recommendations to improve the safety provided by restraining orders is enacting an emergency protection order law, like the one we are dealing with today. House Bill 2776A provides law enforcement with the capacity to seek an immediate, temporary, no-contact order from a judge on a 24-hour basis. It automatically expires in 7 days. We had a group of technical experts craft the language in this bill. Law enforcement helped make sure the mechanics of this process would work statewide. We also had input from domestic violence prevention advocates and defense attorneys. I just want to highlight a few shocking statistics to put it in perspective. 9%, about 78,000 of Oregon women reported being physically assaulted by an intimate partner in the past 5 years. During just one day in September of 2013, 1,187 victims were served by local domestic violence programs in Oregon. Domestic violence has tragic results, and just to be clear, it's not only the persons involved in the altercations that are at risk. Children and other family members and law enforcement officers are also endangered. House Bill 2776A is just one small but necessary tool to help better protect the victims of domestic violence. It has both the support of the domestic violence and law enforcement communities. It passed the House with no opposition, as Representative Parrish mentioned, and I urge your aye vote.
All right, thank you. Questions for the representatives? All right, thank you all very much. I want to go ahead and recess House Bill 2776A, public hearing, and for the purpose of opening up a public hearing on House Bill 3040A.
Jeff? Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, House Bill 3040A comes to us from Representatives Huffman and Taylor. This bill has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact and directs the Oregon Law Commission to conduct a study and make recommendations for changes to law relating to hearsay and criminal actions involving sex trafficking. The bill directs the commission to make recommendations to the interim committee of the Legislative Assembly related to judiciary no later than December 31, 2015. There are no amendments.
All right, thank you. Who would like to start off?
I will. Chair Brzozinski, committee members, John Huffman, state representative from House District 59. House Bill 3040 is another one of our sex trafficking bills that our work group came into the session with, and it's evolved throughout the session, and so there are some certified smart people that have been working on it with us from Multnomah County DA's office and other partners that are going to explain the background of the bill, what we were trying to accomplish, and where we're going with it as the Law Commission has agreed to take on this project in the interim. And so I'm going to turn it over to Rep. Taylor, but just, you know, wanted to give you a little background, set the stage for where the bill came from and what we're hoping to accomplish. Thank you.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Taylor, House District 41. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about the House Bill 3040A relating to the hearsay evidence in sex trafficking cases. Representative Huffman and I participated in the interim work group on the commercial sexual exploitation of children. Those meetings had a wide variety of stakeholders: Senator Ron Wyden, Attorney General, Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, Commissioner Diane McKeel, as well as law enforcement, agency personnel, health professionals, child advocates, and more. The Multnomah County District Attorneys brought forth the concept for the original version of House Bill 3040, which would allow the admissibility of certain hearsay statements as evidence in sex trafficking cases. It was modeled after hearsay exception for victims of domestic violence already in statute. Not unlike domestic violence victims, sex trafficked individuals are often frightened, have left town, or otherwise unavailable by the time of trial. They often recant earlier statements about traffickers. This bill would have given prosecutors more tools to convict traffickers and abusers who prey on these vulnerable women. Unfortunately, the crime of sex trafficking has some technical issues that are different from domestic violence issues. So House Bill 3040A asks the Oregon Law Commission to review this issue and make recommendations about language for a hearsay exception for sex trafficking. They have the skill and expertise to craft language that takes into account the nuances in sex trafficking cases. Just yesterday, I heard from the Law Commission that the time frame outlined may be too aggressive. So we're certainly willing to work with them to make that more manageable if necessary. But prosecuting sex traffickers is an unpleasant and technically difficult endeavor. We need to give prosecutors the tools they need to put these offenders in jail. The bill passed the House floor with no opposition, and I urge your support.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, with the letter from the Law Commission yesterday, they're still very interested in taking this on, but instead of being prepared to come back with the bill in 2016, we might be looking to push it out to 2017 if necessary.
All right, so we have a letter. I have the letter. Letter tells me what I know from being a commissioner on the Law Commission. We do not just mandate the commission to do stuff. It's very, very, very rarely have this body, without consultation, forced them to take on a project because of their limited resources. They're all volunteers and their expertise as to whether it's a good fit. So I'm more than willing for us to be working with them in consultation to see whether or not they can, in fact, take this on during this endeavor during the interim. Personally, I want to hear the testimony. I think what we need to be looking at is what are our other alternatives I don't know why this needs to go to the Law Commission to actually get the results that we want. They rarely have done anything in the area of criminal law. I've asked them to actually take on and redo the criminal code in its entirety, since it has not been revamped since its passage back in the early 70s. That fell on deaf ears, and that's like a 3 to 4 year project. I understand that. But again, we have the Law Commission already set with multiple different projects that they're working on now. And the way I understand that they've kind of maybe giving a different focus, but basically on what their letter says and what I know of how their workload will be, they'd have to just stop everything that they're doing and shift into this other thing under the timeline we have. And I understand and I respect that they may still be ready to do that, but that's something that we need to work on. But what I wanted to do is get your testimony on. I want this on the record because it's been sent to us. It should be a public record as to their hesitation based on what is currently called for in the bill. And I have not had any of the subsequent conversations with them. So at this point, we'll get the testimony in. We'll figure out what we can do as a body in the sense of whether we can do this internally through a work group, through the judiciary, as compared to asking the Law Commission to take on an endeavor that they're looking at who's on the list and what their expertise, criminal law is not there. I mean, myself and maybe one of the judges would have that background from what I'm looking at, but virtually everyone here are practicing in the arena of civil law. So other comments or questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just say to get to our goal, that would be fine, not particular which path we take to get there.
That sounds great.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and recess that one because we have a lot of people, but I have a couple other bills. I want to go ahead and get those taken care of so we can focus exclusively on this one. So we'll recess 3040, and we're going to go up to... Let's go ahead and go back to 2776A, reopen the public hearing on that. And on that bill, I have at this point Kevin Campbell and Sybil Hebb. If y'all would come forward while they're coming forward, is there anyone else here today who wants to testify on 2776A? Whoever would like to go first.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and we're strongly in support of House Bill 2776A. This came to us through, as was mentioned already, our Lake Oswego police chief, who was aware that this particular provision was in place in other states, gave officers a tool in instances where they believed somebody in a domestic disturbance would be at risk. And this bill then provides the officer the ability to approach the victim with the idea of seeking an emergency protective order. So the key here is it is a order based on probable cause that the victim in the domestic disturbance is at an immediate risk of physical harm. That probable cause, along with consent by the victim, would allow the officer to move forward to get the limited emergency protective order. It would last 7 days, 7 calendar days. The challenge here is that somebody that's involved in a domestic disturbance situation, a victim where the officer clearly discerns there's an issue there of danger, is left to their own devices if the officer doesn't have a tool to seek protection through the courts. And as you know, somebody that's in a situation where they're experiencing victimization, they're dealing with a number of issues all at once. The abuse, fear, sometimes seeking shelter. They have a number of issues they are having to address, seeking also to address and navigate a court system on their own. When the officer believes and has probable cause to believe there's immediate danger to that person in place, is a challenge that is resolved through this bill. I think it provides a tool. We've worked closely with advocates And we think we have a tool here that really works, and we hope that the committee will support this bill moving forward. And we appreciate the time that you're taking to hear it and to consider it today. Thank you.
Thank you. Sybil.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here, also in support of House Bill 2776. And I echo the comments of those who have come before me and will just reiterate my thanks for the sponsors and also the great collaboration between law enforcement and the district attorneys, and also particularly the defense attorneys who worked with us to come forward with amendments that will work for everybody. And I'll just share, as a new attorney in my first job, I worked at a legal aid office in Bend, and at that time we served both Klamath Lake, or all of Klamath Lake, Crook, Jefferson, and Deschutes counties. And as you can imagine, it was very difficult for us to get to everybody who needed help for us. And I remember taking a call from a woman who lived in Lapine, which is about 30 to 40 minutes from the Bend courthouse, and it was a Friday afternoon, and she was in great danger, and she was seeking information about how to apply for a restraining order, and there was no way she could have gotten to the courthouse in time to submit an application, even if we had been able to get the courts to find a judge to hear from her. Usually they heard restraining order applications only at 10 a.m. or at 1 p.m., and so she just didn't have a situation that met or meshed with the procedural options that were available to her. And so finding a way to get her protection through the weekend till she could get into the court on Monday was a very difficult challenge. So this bill will really help in those circumstances, and we appreciate all the work. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2776A. Go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2776A.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 2776A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2776A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. The chair is willing to carry, but does someone else like to carry it?
I'd be happy to.
All right. Senator Thatcher will be our carrier. We'll close the work session on 2776A, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2980A.
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, House Bill 2980A comes to us from Representative Bentz. This bill authorizes a defendant to request a district attorney to approve an extension of a stay of criminal proceedings in a district attorney diversion. It requires the court to grant an extension upon district attorney approval and allows the defendant to request extension even after a district attorney files a request for termination. There's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact and no amendments to this bill.
All right, thank you. Gail? I saw Doug listed. Did he have to go?
I'm channeling Doug.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
While she's getting ready to channel Doug Harcourt, let me see if anyone else wants to be channeled for testimony. We're going to see if there's going to be more channeling here. House Bill 2988, is there anyone else who wants to testify? All right, Gail, is this coming first from you or from Doug? We want to know what channel we're on.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is Doug speaking because I actually wasn't going to testify, but we like the bill. It is being introduced at the request of the District Attorneys Association. DA diversions are just that. It's all about the DA. They are the gatekeeper going in, and as the statutes currently read, it's a finite period of time when you have to be under diversion supervision. If you don't complete everything by the end of that time frame, boom, the period of time is over. And what this bill does do is it gives a safety valve at the back end of it. If you're almost done, not quite done, you ask the district attorney, please, can we have some more time? Don't terminate my diversion yet. And it basically opens up that back door with a little bit of relief. And so we thought that was a good thing. We appreciate the district attorney's introducing the bill. We support it. Encourage your aye vote. Mr. Harcourt was concerned about the summary provision there. In the dark ink, it says that it authorizes the defendant to request the district attorney to approve extension of marijuana possession diversion period. Actually, if you read the bill, it's not specific to any kind of diversion. It's just I guess Section 2 does. Yeah, Section 2 does. It's fine.
Yeah, I was going to say the summary doesn't control anyway.
It's fine.
My understanding is broader than just the marijuana diversion.
Right, correct. Well, it amends both diversion statutes in Section 1 and in Section 2. Yeah.
Okay. Questions for Gail or for Doug? All right.
Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2980A. Open up a work session on House Bill 2980A.
Adjourn to House Bill 2980A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2980A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Farioli is actually listed on the bill as a sponsor, so we'll give him first opportunity. If not, Chair will carry as a backup, but we'll put Farioli first. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2980A. We're going to reopen our public hearing that we opened up previously on House Bill 3040A. And at this point, I'm going to ask Kelly Cloyd, Nita Bellis, maybe, and Cheryl Heinstra. Why don't you all three come up first? So I'm not sure, Kelly, if you want to go first or Cheryl. I'm assuming that y'all are going to give us some background stuff before we hear from Nita.
Okay. Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Cloyd, and I work for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I've been a prosecutor with that office for 5.5 years, and I've been prosecuting sex trafficking cases for the last two. My office actually came to me a while ago and asked us to start this sex trafficking hearsay exception bill, and it definitely has transformed throughout the session. But really, we are just very happy that it's still in the mix and still very much alive and being debated. In Oregon, because of the I-5 corridor, it makes transportation of victims very easy. And so we actually have seen victims traveling from all the way down to Medford and Klamath Falls up to Portland and going on this circuit. And so we want to make sure that we prosecute these traffickers to the fullest extent possible, obviously preserving their constitutional rights as well. But these cases are very difficult. They're like putting together a puzzle when you're prosecuting them. You have to collect all these tiny little pieces to make the picture of what is going on and what has happened. And one of those pieces is definitely the victim, and that has to be the hardest piece to put together. These victims are scared. They're oftentimes in love with their traffickers because this is very much a domestic violence type situation. And oftentimes they're either too afraid to come to court or they are still very much in love with their trafficker and just aren't ready to break that tie yet. And so we have to make these cases by just kind of piecemealing their statements together. One of the ways that we have been able to do that in domestic violence cases has been the hearsay exception. We can't use statements that are made to law enforcement when victims are not present, but when a victim is present in the courtroom and testifies to something totally different than they told the police officer, then we can bring the police officer in and have the police officer talk about what the victim told them. And we'd like to do similar things in sex trafficking cases as well. Obviously, this is all guarded by the trafficker's constitutional rights. So currently, we would like to ask that this issue still be considered. Part of the problem is that I think that there's been some issues with defense versus prosecution and guarding defendants' rights versus being able to prosecute our cases fully. And while maybe the Oregon Law Commission is not the best place to do that, it sounds like we would like the opportunity to still work on this issue and to come up with a solution that is good for both sides. So thank you, Chair Przanski. Thank you, committee members. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you. Let's go ahead and get the rest of the testimony, then we'll take questions then. Cheryl?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. Here today just to basically echo Kelly. There are some enduring challenges with this particular type of case, and hearsay is very technically complex, balancing the interests between both getting the evidence we need, the interests of the defendant, and the integrity of the judicial process. So the Department of Justice is happy to and would love to be a part of whatever work group gets worked out. Thank you.
I already got two volunteers sitting here at the counter, so I would really appreciate that at this point. Anita?
Hi, my name is Nita Bells. Thank you, Senator Prozanski, and members of the committee for hearing this and for keeping this bill going. I am the managing director of In Our Backyard and oversee Central Oregonians Against Trafficking Humans in Central Oregon, as well as I work in Super Bowl every year in anti-human trafficking efforts and have a couple of books out. I'm here because I never want to let it be forgotten that there's human trafficking throughout the state. I'm in Bend, and I would like to talk to you about a couple of cases on our side of the mountain. First, a story of a young woman I'll call Mary, and she was trafficked from the time she was 12 years old. That was probably she was groomed for that, because at 9 years of age, a relative began sexually abusing her. In her 30s, she was still being trafficked, and her trafficker broke her back in a fit of rage. Days after her surgery, she couldn't walk out of the house. Her trafficker posted her on Backpage and brought customers, sex buyers, into the house and had her sold in her house, in her bed, while she was trying to recover from a broken back produced by the trafficker. After years of this kind of treatment and brutal beatings, threatened murder to her and her family, tremendous verbal abuse and threats, she testified at his sentencing, "I'm not only a victim, I'm a survivor of human trafficking. I'm thankful to be here to see my trafficker punished." When I met her in Bend a couple years ago, Mary was in her mid-30s, and she was working hard to recover. She talked about her joy at being able to be in a shelter there. We house survivors of human trafficking in our domestic violence shelter there in Bend, and they do a fantastic job. She was thankful for the support she was given. Her trafficker was in jail finally and waiting trial during the time I was talking to her, so she felt a little more freedom. And although she was a beautiful young woman, and you wouldn't know from talking to her, her emotional development was very young because, again, she had been abused at the age of 9 and had been trafficked from the time she was 12. Today, her biggest excitement is that she's just learned how to ride a bike. And I that kind of tears me up, because it's like we've got to give these people opportunity to ride bikes. Sadly, there are many cases that never come to trial, because victims and survivors are not able to testify at trial, either because of threats on them or their loved ones, or traumatic bonding to their traffickers. That's what the traffickers are counting on, and they know how difficult these cases are to try. Let's give prosecutors tools to prosecute this bill. Let's give law enforcement the confidence that if they work these difficult cases, even if the victim is coerced into testifying, the solid trail of evidence left in cyberspace will be presented as evidence to corroborate the facts of the crime. I want to talk to you briefly about a couple more people. First of all, survivor number two. About 2 weeks ago, we received a call from a young woman who had been offered to go visit a man's family in Bend, and said, you know, come on, I want you to meet my parents, come on over. And when she got to Bend, he rented a hotel room and told her she'd been advertised on Backpage and that she'd be prostituting and giving him every penny for the next few days. In Bend, Little Bend, Oregon, the first hour she was posted on Backpage, she received 6 calls requesting sex. Her trafficker had beaten her pretty badly when she said she didn't want to do that. And when she told one of the wannabe sex buyers she was on her way to hospital, the sex buyer said to her, "Gee, maybe we could have some company while you're waiting for the ambulance." That's about as low as I can think of anything. She escaped, but she didn't want to involve law enforcement because she knows from past experience how painful and difficult it is to go through one of these trials and not have it come to court. We've got to stop this atrocity that's happening across our state, and we have to give the courageous victims a way to know that we will help them despite and in the midst of the threats to them and their loved ones. One last person I want to talk about is the author of this book, and I'm bringing testimony from her today. Her name is Wendy Barnes, and she was one of the victims of Greg Hightower and has become a friend of mine. I sent her a message last night, and I asked her, would she like to say something regarding how important it is to get this done. And this is Wendy Barnes' testimony. And I don't know a lot about how this works, but if we could credit her with this, that would be wonderful. These are her hands on the front of this book and getting loose of being cuffed as Greg Hightower's victim. The day he was sentenced to life was the day that I could breathe again. At that point, I knew I was safe and I could live my life without constant fear. And so I would just ask that we give these courageous survivors the freedom they need to learn to ride the bike and other activities.
All right, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Questions for anyone on the panel? Ladies, thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel includes Gail Meyer, Wakla, and Joel Shapiro. While they're getting situated, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 3040A? All right, who'd like to go first?
I'm going last.
Okay. I appreciate that. So that means either Gail or Joel are going first. Or going second.
You go. You go.
Okay.
But Joel go first.
Yeah. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. I'm Joel Shapiro. I'm here testifying today on behalf of the Kids Are Not For Sale in Oregon campaign and Shared Hope International. And I won't belabor a lot of the background on the issue of child sex trafficking, but I appreciate the other testimony from witnesses that have explained how prevalent this crime is in Oregon. We know that it's gotten a lot of attention and that it's a very difficult crime for law enforcement to prosecute. And that's how this bill came forward from the work group that was started by Representative Tomei and succeeded by Representative Huffman and Representative Taylor. And we, as you've heard from the other witnesses, we had a lot of involvement in that work group, and a lot of thought has gone into this this issue. And I also want to just share that that for this bill in particular, coming out of the work group, there was a lot of support. So this bill has been endorsed by the Oregon Chiefs of Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Junior League. We have representative from Junior League of Eugene here today. We had Junior League of Portland testify on the House side. Other groups include Hope 82, the Oregon Family Council, the CSEC and VSIT program coordinator of Janus Youth, with Heart Wide Open Ministries, Fast Northwest, who's here in our backyard, Abolish Child Trafficking in Southern Oregon. So thank you for hearing those. I wanted to put that on the record. We had about 220 Oregonians write in on this bill to their legislators, and over 700 people support the Facebook campaign behind this bill. So I'll just talk briefly about the process that went into this bill. So there has been some disagreement with the OCDLA over the constitutional aspects of this bill. And when we talked about it on the House side, that raised some questions in the committee members' minds. And I think because of those concerns and the bill coming right at the deadline, there was not very much time to wade through the complexities that have been referred to. I mean, the constitutionality has developed through case law, particularly the Crawford case at the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'll talk about that in just a moment, but then also considering the Oregon appellate court's constitutional rulings that apply to hearsay exceptions, and particularly the domestic violence hearsay exception. And so the rationale for this bill is very similar to the rationale that led to the domestic violence hearsay exception, and Kelly Cloyd alluded to that a little bit, and others, in that you have a relationship between the parties that are involved in the statements that are coming forward. There's an opportunity for coercion, for violence, for pressure that makes a statement made close in time to a trial or at trial perhaps not as reliable as a statement made earlier in time, where there is actually an incentive to tell the truth and not an incentive to fabricate, which is a very important consideration in hearsay jurisprudence. So the hearsay rule, really the hallmark of it is to make sure that reliable evidence does come into court and less reliable evidence is going to be excluded. And that's a decision that a judge makes on a case-by-case, fact-by-fact inquiry when hearsay evidence is offered from a declarant. And so it's not the purpose of a hearsay exception to create a barrier so that some potential evidence is not going to be admitted that on a fact-by-fact basis. That's not the purpose of the statute. That's the purpose of the inquiry made by the judge. And, you know, I know that a lot of you understand that, but I'm trying to clarify that for the record. So
we're going to have a work group.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be making that decision today. I appreciate putting some stuff on the record. I'm going to make some comments at the end as to how I think this should be focused and where I think it's going to be going. So.
Okay. Well, in that case, let me just cut short my testimony. I do want to read from the Crawford ruling, because I think that is important. And Crawford has to do with changing the constitutional protections to the criminal defendant that Kelly Cloyd referred to. And it had to do with creating a distinction that really didn't exist before between testimonial and non-testimonial evidence. But it says that where non-testimonial evidence is at issue, it is wholly consistent with the framers' design to afford the states flexibility in the development of their hearsay law, as does Roberts' decision, as would an approach that exempted such statements from the Confrontation Clause scrutiny altogether. So that's dealing with that. And then I just want to briefly read from Oregon Appellate State versus Wilcox, which is the case that upheld the domestic violence hearsay exception. And it says that in order for hearsay to be admissible, that the court has to be able to find particularized guarantees of trustworthiness. And in that case, the statements are based on the victim's personal knowledge. They are detailed and specific, and they were made under surrounding circumstances, including the time of disclosure, the victim's demeanor, and the lack of any evident motive to fabricate that would support their trustworthiness. So as long as the court is able to make those kinds of findings, then a hearsay exception can be constitutional. And in fact, OCDLA testified at the House hearing that facially the original bill as written was not unconstitutional. And I'll wrap it up there.
Thank you.
Chair Prasonsky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Actually, I'm a little disappointed to hear that the OLC is evidently indicating it's not the willing recipient of a referral on this. We were looking very forward to having this discussion in the presence of lawyers because we feel it is really legally quite technical. Anytime that there's a codification of a hearsay exception, that it interlaces and there's an overlay of constitutional rights of the accused to confront their accuser. And so hearsay very much is riddled and laden with all of those implications. And we were also aware that not all states have followed suit in enacting their own domestic violence exceptions, but that certainly Oregon would be the very first in the nation to codify something that even goes further than that with this codification for a a purported human sex trafficking exception. It was postured in the nature of inherent reliability of certain text messages and Facebook postings, and it just gets very complicated. So if there is going to be a work group, Chair Pozonski, what I would ask is please populate it with lawyers, litigators who understand 803, who understand constitutional rights, because this is not purely a political discussion. It really is a legal one. And we were looking forward to having this discussion with the OLC. If we have it internally within the building, my ask is that we have it with lawyers. Thank you.
Wynn Wakala. What am I? Let's see. I started hearing or learning about human trafficking back in 2006, and I started working on it in 2008. I was the first executive director for Oregonians Against Trafficking Humans under the Department of Justice. And then in 2012, I decided to run for state representative against Matt Wingard. And so I started my own organization called FAST, which stands for Fight Against Sex Trafficking and also Fight Against Slavery / Trafficking. During all this time, I've ran across a lot of witnesses, a lot of survivors, and heard a lot of stories. And I must say, I'm very happy that we have a hearsay exception for domestic violence victims. But when you look at human trafficking victims, and I don't like to exaggerate, I would say it's at least 10 times worse. Number one, they have more than one person they're doing this to. Number two, unlike a wife, these girls can't go down to the street to the supermarket and run into a neighbor who says, oh, how did you get that black eye? These girls are beaten much more often than domestic violence victims. And number three, they're not even old enough to be married to the guy, a lot of them. Some of the things that these people that I've talked to, survivors, have said that even if they won't beat them, they'll threaten to beat one of the younger girls in the group that maybe that older girl has kind of taken under her wing and tried to protect. So these people, I'm so glad and excited that you're trying to move forward fast, name of my organization, because this is just horrific, and these people need even more protection. I want to say at least 10 times more protection than domestic violence victims. It's that bad. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3040A. And I am looking at a work group, and I had already started writing down. I do believe this is a very highly technical area that practitioners need to be there. I'm not sure how big the group is going to be, but the three key core anchors are going to be the Department of Justice, Oregon District Attorneys Association. And Kelly, I'm hoping that your employer will be willing to allow you to be that individual, because I know you put a lot of work into it at the beginning, and you come in with the expertise that you have. And also, Gail, I will expect that you will be there for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. So those are the three core. I'm going to check with staff and others to see how much more population we need, if any. But to me, I think I'm going to see if I can't get someone from the judicial branch that might be able to also participate at some level, if not as a direct participant. So any other comments on that or anything? All right, so that's going to conclude our work for today. Tomorrow's Wednesday the 20th. We're scheduled to be here at 8:30. We're adjourned until then.